Today, answers matter more than ever before. That's why IBM is helping businesses manage customer questions with Watson Assistant. It's conversational AI designed to work for any industry. Let's put smart to work. Visit ibm.com/Watson Assistant.
And good morning on a Friday.
Woo-hoo!
Keyshawn's here, LZ's here, and as Chris mentioned, I'm John Ireland pinch-hitting for Travis. There's a lot going on. The NBA announced they're coming back. July 31st is the date where they say they're going to start playing games, eight games, and that's to ramp up for the playoffs. There may or may not be a play-in tournament for the eighth spot, and then they're off and running. Guys, there's a couple things I want to ask you about here. There's a potential on October 12th, that's a Monday. Now, a lot can happen between now and then, but you know, we need to make sure we don't have a second wave of the pandemic. Everybody needs to go on as scheduled. A lot needs to happen. But let's think positive and say a lot happens and everything gets in and we're playing games. On Monday night, October 12th, it could be Game 7 of the NBA Finals. It could also be Monday Night Football, Chargers-Saints. Now, I know you guys pay attention to stuff like this. The NFL almost never loses a head-to-head ratings battle. You could put the NFL on against a car chase, and it would beat it. The NFL gets huge ratings. If the NBA and NFL all meet on that night, where do the eyeballs go, Key?
Monday night, it's gonna eyeballs are still. And it also depends on who's playing. But
yeah, if LeBron's in the finals, the NBA runs away with it, I think.
Yeah, it will be one of those deals where and again, most people nowadays, it seems like they got a couple TVs in their house, so you know, it may be a, you know what I'm saying, it may be an NBA game, an NFL game, but for the most part I would think that the NFL still would slightly edge it out, slightly.
Well, eight of the top 10 sporting events last year were NFL games.
Yeah, but a section of the country, you know, as much as we love the NBA, but there's a small section of the country that doesn't really pay attention a whole lot to the NBA as much as they do to the NFL.
LZ, what do you think? If LeBron's not in the finals, if it's two other teams that, and you don't have the biggest star in the game, who wins?
Man, this is so hard. This is so hard because narrative matters, right? If the NFL teams, you know, if the Chargers and, you know, the Saints are both undefeated and they've been kicking everybody's ass, then they're going to win, you know. But if, say, you know, Zion finds a way to slip in and he has an opportunity to do a Magic Johnson and be a rookie and win finals MVP, and he's already got that cachet, and obviously if he were to be this far, he's already led an upset of a whole bunch of great teams, that I think Zion's going to win no matter who's playing in the NFL.
Well, John,
so it really just depends on the narrative going into this night as to what's rolling, what are people buzzing about, what's unexpected, what is expected. And, you know, so it's kind of hard to play.
Well, John, wait a minute, though. You said a Monday night and the NBA championship, right?
Game 7.
So where would they would move one of them to ABC, huh?
Well, the finals would be on ABC anyway.
Oh, so it's not on ESPN, it's on ABC.
Yeah,
anyway.
The Monday night game would be on ESPN.
All right, so it would be ABC, ESPN.
Yeah, and by the way, Key, that's a good point. That makes a difference because not every household gets ESPN. But it leads me to another road I wanted to take you guys down. So we're sitting here talking about, okay, who would win? These baseball players, I don't know if you guys have been following the developments in the last 48 hours, but the owners and the players are getting farther apart. The players suggested 114 games. The owners came back with 50, and the owners rejected the player proposal and said, we're not giving you another one. It's 50. Take it or leave it. And most people think cooler heads will prevail and there'll be a compromise. But guys, let's say there's not. Let's say baseball decides not to play. Isn't that a catastrophic mistake when the NBA and the NFL are taking the field? LZ, would they ever get that audience back? Because if October 12th, that would also be the World Series. The World Series would be going on in early October. If baseball bows out of this, don't they suffer a blow they may never recover from?
I think so. I think that is true.
I don't think so.
The 50 games, they need to take them 50 games because they pay for play. They agreed to that after they cancel spring training. So why is it a problem now?
It's one. It's less than one third of their salary key. Their salary is based on 162 games.
I understand that, but we're not playing 162 games. So if we're not going to play 162, we're only going to play 50. If we're only going to play, all I'm giving you is 25 games. If I'm only giving you 25, and this is what we're going to do, you're getting paid for that because of where we're at in the country with the pandemic.
LZ, you agree? If you were a player, would you take 50 games?
For a player, I would take 50 games because I just want to play, you know, and opportunities to play and win a championship. You only got a finite window to do so, especially in your prime. So I would personally play, but I certainly appreciate where the players are coming from. Listen, all owners in every league look to get as much of a financial advantage as they possibly can. But over these past few off seasons, baseball has really been sneaky, even sneakier than the NFL, in the way that they've been trying to squeeze their players to get their salaries out of control.
But aren't they doing that again here with the 50, LZ? Aren't they doing that again here with the 50 games? Why not play 80?
Can you fit 80 in though?
I don't know.
You can't.
I don't know all of the financial details of the collective of the owners. I've said this before, John, and I'm going to say it again. I think a lot of this motivation also comes from the fact that these owners probably have other businesses that are suffering greatly, and they're looking to do whatever they can to kind of recoup money from Paul so they can pay Peter. I think that dynamic is really at play for baseball players, especially when you look at some of the salaries that have been attached to the best stars, $500 million to get a guy now. So I think that the owners may be more leveraged in baseball than perhaps in other sports. But there's also the fact that these games are likely going to be paid with a smaller amount of revenue coming in from fans, right? They're not going to have the numbers.
Correct.
And if they're anticipating trying to pay, you know, for 100 games, and in 100 games you still aren't going to recoup enough money to do all of that, then it's not financially beneficial for them to play that many games under these circumstances. So I understand both sides, but the baseball owners, they're real slick, and they will use this pandemic to squeeze players because we've seen them do things of this nature before to get these salaries under control, not signing guys, letting them dangle out there for weeks and weeks and months. You know, no one can prove collusion, but it certainly looks smelly and fishy and disgusting. And I see them doing some of the same things in the way that they're talking about, you know, cutting guys' salaries by these large percentile points while not showing them the books so they can see that these asks that they're making are justified.
Well, see, John, for me, as a player, I've always looked at it as I play the games, I get paid for the amount of games that I play. If there's 17 games being played or 16 games being played in the NFL season, I'm being paid over 17 weeks. For each game, that's the way it's being broken down. However you want to do the math. And you say, well, if you get hurt, Key, you still going to make that money if you miss 10 games. They're still paying you the 16 games. Yes, that is correct. But we also are in a regular season. We also have 70,000 people in the stands. We also have merchandising sales. We also have all of those sort of things. If I'm a player in baseball with this going on right now, I certainly don't want to look selfish to try and get more money than that's out there when I'm only playing 50 games. If I can play 60, I'll play 60. If we can play 80, play 80. But I'm not going to push it because I want to get out on the field. I want to play, and I want to give people something
right
to cheer about.
Well, to go back to LZ's point about how the owners tend to squeeze the players, Key, if they agreed today, if the baseball players and owners agreed today, they could have spring training for the rest of June, so about 3.5 weeks of spring training, start on July 1st, and easily play 80 games, and that includes taking days off. They could, you know, if you played every day, that would be 90 games, but they, you know, you got to give them days off. So give them 10 days off sprinkled in. There's your 80 games. And I think that's a reasonable thing to do for both the players and the owners. But you guys are right. They may have to make a decision of maybe take it or leave it at 50. And it's going to get very interesting whether they take it or not, because I know they don't want to play 50. They want to play more. So we'll see what happens. Mike Tannenbaum coming up at the bottom of the hour. And a good Friday morning to you. Keyshawn, LZ, and Travis. I'm John Ireland, pinch hitting for Travis. And You know, guys, we're having very candid conversations this week, really over the past 2 weeks, about race. And by the way, LZ, I want to compliment you. The way I discovered the piece you did, the video essay you did for the LA Times, was that Keyshawn retweeted it. And I follow both you guys on Twitter, and I caught it when Key sent it out. I thought the piece you did when you went into the protest and basically walked with people and got their side of the story was extraordinary. What's the reaction been like for you to that piece?
Well, first of all, thank you. And, Shout out to Mark Potts, you know, the videographer and editor who brave, you know, no fear. You know, I love when I have a cameraman with no fear, because I have no fear. And, you know, it was good. He was really. So, you know, I was in Arizona, John. I don't know if you know this or not, but I was in Arizona.
Yeah, I did know you were down there.
Basically since March. Got a house there, just stayed there because of the pandemic. But what I was witnessing in coverage, especially nationally, was this focus on the rioting, the looters, and less conversations happening with the protesters. And so I drove back on early Sunday morning, parked the car, and went immediately into the streets, met up with my videographer, because I thought it was important that the protesters' voices were heard, that they were documented, and that, you know, I use my platform to remind people how we got here. We didn't get here because people needed, you know, surfboards and I saw someone steal a cat tree and all this other BS. That's not why we're in the streets. That's not why these protesters were in the streets. We're there because it is justified murder at the hands of police officers. And that's what the protesters were talking about. So I wanted to make sure that focus was there. And I'm not going to sit here and say I changed a whole lot, but I have seen a lot more stories now be directed towards what the protesters want and what they're talking about. They're still covering the rioting and the looting, but I am happy to see that more outlets, whether they're local or national, talk about the real issue that got us here in the first place, and that's the death and what the protesters want to see changed.
All right, so here's a tangent,
John,
on that. Go ahead, Key.
And John, after all he just said, right, all the positive stuff the brother was doing, had the helmet on, all that. He sent me out in the streets with flip-flops on, protesting.
I did not. Nope.
He didn't tell me the rules of protesting. He didn't say, Keith, get your Ultra Boost Adidas on. Make sure you got shorts and a T-shirt because it's 100 degrees. He got me out there in board shorts, a T-shirt, and flip-flops, toes burning and feet hurting.
Now, how that John didn't show up in your video, LZ, I'll never know. And I may never forgive you.
John?
Yeah.
John? Yeah. We spent 4 hours with the protesters that day. I marched with them from the very beginning all the way to the end. I didn't see one pair of flip-flops. Why he retweeted a video but didn't notice everybody was wearing shoes, I do not know. That, yeah. I don't take the L for
I would think that's inherent, Key, that you would wear shoes to a march, but I'll let it go. Hey, I want to get to this, guys. There was an extraordinary interview yesterday on Golic and Wingo, which airs really early in the morning here, with Torrey Hunter. Torrey was an all-star outfielder for the Twins and the Angels. And he was talking about playing in Boston. You know, for years, athletes have said playing in Boston, particularly for black athletes, is not easy. Adam Jones, the outfielder, said he'd been called the N-word 100 times there. CeCe Sabathia said it's the only place where he's ever been called the N-word. And Torrey Hunter, who played with David Ortiz in Minnesota, so he's friends with Ortiz, was once asked, will you come join me and play with me on the Red Sox? And Hunter said, no way. And yesterday, he was asked about that on Golic and Wingo. I want you guys to listen to this, and then I'll let you react to it. Here's Torrey Hunter.
I've been called the N-word in Boston 100 times, and I said something about it. You know, and, oh, he's just a militant. He's lying. This didn't happen. No, it happened all the time from little kids. And grown-ups right next to him didn't say anything. You know, but you know what? Don't say anything. So I had a no-trade clause in everything I had not to go to Boston. Not because of all the people, not because of the teammates, not because of the front office. Because if you're doing that and allowing it amongst the people, I don't want to be there. And that's why I had a no-trade clause to Boston. Oh, in every contract I've ever had. So, and I always wanted to play for him. And it sucks.
All right, Key, is this something that's well known? that you guys get treated differently in Boston?
Man, absolutely. When I played for the Jets and we'll go up to New England to play the Patriots, oh, them people was vicious. I can't even count on both hands how many times I heard it. I remember Brian Cox, you know, standing next to Brian Cox. You know, I used to stand next to him a lot.
Who was your teammate on the Jets? Yeah.
Yeah, it was my teammate on Jets, and we would always, you know, he was just one of my guys. And, you know, we had to restrain B. Cox from going up in the stands a couple times because it was crazy. But you know what, man, it seems like to me that's the culture of the fan base in that particular area. All the way back as I can remember, as just growing and knowing the history of the Boston Celtics and what Bill Russell had to go through, even though they enjoyed his play on the court, it wasn't so great off the court at times. So you hear it all the time, John. You hear it all. You do a trip a year up there, and I'm sure
guys that
have played in the NBA, in particular on the Lakers, probably have shared stories with you of the past.
Yeah, but I guess, LZ, I thought that was because we were the Lakers and they just hated us because we were purple and gold. But you say that being black in Boston is a completely different deal?
So, you know, there's two different ways in which you can look at diversity, right? Boston is a very diverse city. You know, it's diverse. There's a lot going on in large part because it's also a hub of some of the top universities on the planet. And so they tend to just attract a lot of diversity from the academic perspective. But there are black people in Boston and black people in positions of power and blah, blah, blah. Same thing in Chicago, same thing in L.A., same thing in Manhattan. Here's the difference.
Same thing in Boston, Mississippi, same thing in Alabama.
Yes. But Boston is one of the most segregated cities still. And with that segregation comes tribalization. And at sporting events, all these different tribes are forced to be with each other. And that's when you start to notice, oh, just because you're diverse doesn't mean you're integrated. Just because you are diverse doesn't mean you're included. And so whenever I'm in Boston, you know, I am very cognizant of my surroundings because I'm not very familiar with the city. So I always make sure that I'm looking at where I'm at because I know, just like in certain other parts of the city, okay, this part of town belongs to these people, this part of town belongs to these people, this may not be good for me here, this may not be good for me there. Manhattan, New York handles diversity way differently because they're forced to be integrated in their everyday lives. In Boston, you can stay in your little pocket forever. And the only other time you see someone different from you is when you actually forcefully go in and find yourself in a situation where there is diversity in one area, and the sporting events is where that happens.
Key, is it so bad that you would have done what Torrey Hunter did? If they would have come to you and said, Key, we're trading you to the Patriots, would you have balked at it because you would have had to move your family there and be amongst this?
You know, it all depends, I think, on who. I had a relationship with Bill Belichick, so I probably would. And I have a relationship with Mr. Kraft, so I probably could have gotten over that sort of stuff. And I would have certainly have spoken out. I mean, I'm sure I can't go back and remember exactly post game, but I'm sure I mentioned it in some post games to some of our beat reporters before. But because of Mr. Kraft and because of Belichick, it may have gotten me to think differently about playing on the team, because on the team and being on the team has nothing to do with the negativity and the stupidity on the perimeter. So that's how I always kind of look at things. The team is your sacred place. That's different than some of the things on the outside. I mean, I played for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and you don't think in Tampa Bay they had some of the same issues in Tampa that they may have in Boston? I mean, it's, you know, imagine Tampa Bay wasn't one of my funnest moments in terms of being in the community. It was cool to play on the team and win the championship and be there, but it was some, you talk about some nasty people. It was some nasty people down there.
Huh. I just think this thing in Boston is one of those things that you guys all know about, that African Americans know about, and white people just look the other way on. I've never heard anybody explain it how Torrey Hunter explained it. That it's, you know, it was so bad that he put a clause in his contract that he wouldn't go there. And
so you look like when you look at, I ain't joking, but you can do that pretty much with any baseball. But when you look at the Red Sox baseball, like in, you watching the games, I mean, you don't see no brothers in them stands.
Yeah, but we don't see him in, we don't see him in Green Bay. LZ, when we watch the Utah Jazz, we don't see him in Utah. But I've never heard it laid out the way Torrey Hunter did.
But when you hear about Utah, you hear things, right?
Yeah, maybe.
You've been, so that's all I'm saying. When you hear about the Utah fan base, you hear some of the same things that you hear about the Boston fan base.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you this. I think that, what we're finding out over the past 2 weeks is that you guys, because of the color of your skin, hear a lot different things than I do when I'm walking down the street. And that's what a lot of this is about, is accepting that. You know, people have been saying for years that the cops treat us differently than they treat you, and nobody was believing it or nobody wanted to accept it until this video came out. And when we got it on tape, I think everything changed.
Get on your tanning bed, you'll start to look like me.
Coming up next, a man who had the unmitigated gall to once trade Keyshawn Johnson. Former GM of the Jets, Mike Tannenbaum, will join us. Talk a little NFL next. Keyshawn, LZ, and Travis. I'm John Ireland, pinch hitting on 710 ESPN.
Hello, this is your apartment. I need some favors from you. Your cat keeps rubbing against the kitchen island, and I can't return the favor. Can you give her extra pets for me? After that, could you bundle your renters and car insurance with GEICO? We could save money, and it's easy to do online. And one last thing. Could you leave the TV on during the day? I need to catch up on my soaps.
GEICO. For bundling made easy, go to geico.com today.
Keyshawn, LZ, and Travis. Good morning, everybody. It is 7:30, and we're going to call an audible here. We have a chance to track down Torrey Hunter, who we were just talking about, and we'll get to Mike Tannenbaum, too, but we're working on that. We were just talking about Torrey, who did an interview yesterday. Torrey played for the Twins, the Angels, and the Tigers, had a great Major League Baseball career, was a five-time All-Star, won 9 consecutive Gold Glove Awards as a center fielder, 2 Silver Slugger Awards. He was LZ, I know when you're working locker rooms, you know, he was our go-to guy in the media. If you needed somebody who could talk about a win or a loss, who would face the music no matter what and give you a great 30 seconds to a minute on anything, Torrey was the guy we went to. And I was surprised to hear that in his career, his whole career, and he played 18 years, he had a clause in his contract that said, you can't trade me to Boston because of the way they treat black people. It's just a different treatment of us when we go there. And I think it's one of those things that's underreported, but we're working on trying to track him down. And Key, you say this is well known in professional sports, just maybe not talked about openly.
Well, I think that once you leave, like in football, you may go there once a year if you're within the division.
Right.
But for the most part, otherwise you visiting maybe twice in your entire career if you have a long career. In baseball and basketball in particular, you're there a little bit more. But, yeah, people and black athletes know what's up with Boston.
Well, speaking of that, Torrey Hunter is online now. Torrey is one of the best players I ever covered at the Angels. Just an absolute – a great hitter who was a stellar fielder. Torrey, how are you holding up, man? How you doing?
And I'm holding up. And I always say, you know, after a storm, there's got to be a rainbow. You know, we're going through, you know, a rough time right now, 2020. But I don't think we're going to go back to normal. I think we're going to be better than normal.
Yes,
you know,
sir.
With all this stuff going on with COVID-19, all the racial divide, the racial tension in America right now, and the injustice. I mean, it's just so much going on. I think a lot of people out here are just more aware, and their eyes are opening. They're starting to listen. They're starting to hear and see. So I'm excited for what's to come. You know, for all people, not just for us as African Americans. But for all people, because it's going to take all of us to really make change. And once you change your mindset, then system changes and all the other things change. So I think we're doing a lot better here in America than we were just 3 months ago.
T Hunt, I got a job for you, man. I just took a job in a major company up in Boston. I need you to come work with me. you ready to do that?
Well, yeah, I mean, Keyshawn, man, at this point, man, I own my own businesses, man.
Say, hey, look, it sound like look, you can, it sound like you got a clause in your businesses to not go to Boston.
I won't go there, buddy. Let him go there. Man, it was a tough time. You know, we go there, and I always wanted to play with Boston, and you know, but my first time in 2000, not really my first time, but my first time hearing it was 2000, and I heard it, and I looked up, it was two little boys, you know, saying the N-word, and I told the cop there, I told the parents, I mean, shut them up, and they was like, no, they throw their hands up, like, you know, like it's a joke. I'm like, no, you're going to teach those two little boys right now, which from 2000, they might be grown-ups, and they got hate in their heart because you didn't stop that right then and there. And that's the same thing with our culture. We say, hey, you're black, you can't do this. You're black, you can't go here. You can't go in that neighborhood. You're black. When we tell our kids that, then you tell them that they're inferior, that they're not accepted in the world. You know, you're not appreciated because of what your skin color is. And it's tough to have that conversation with my sons. You know, my mom had that with me and my brothers, and their parents had that with their, hey, be careful. You can't do this. You're black. Be careful. That can't go in the same sentence. You're black and you can't do this. Then you let me know that my skin color is inferior and we're a threat. And so we grow up feeling that way. Some people can handle it. Some people can't. Some people overcome it. Some people don't. You know, so be careful what you tell your kids, not just for African Americans, for whites, for Asians, for the Latino brothers, for anybody. You just got to make sure what you teach your kids is the right thing for humanity.
Tory, I absolutely agree with you 100%. And I just want to say, as a native Detroiter, thank you for your season of service. we appreciate it.
You know, he don't want to be in no. Why would he want to be a dirty lost, ass Detroit?
We lost Curtis Granderson via trade, so we needed some brothers out there in the field. So I appreciate you being out there.
Man, let me tell you, I left the Angels and I was sick, man. I was hurt because I really wanted to play out there and stay out there. But I went to Detroit, and I'm like, man, I'm going. When I was in Minnesota, they were my enemy. Now I'm going to Detroit, and when I got there, I had Prince Fielder and, you know, Verlander, Austin Jackson, and all these guys, and Miguel Cabrera. I never laughed so much in my life. The city embraced me and my wife. She didn't want to leave after 2 years of playing there. And we look back and we say, might have been one of our favorite times in playing in Detroit.
Good.
It was amazing.
Hey, we're talking to Tory Hunter. Tory, we were talking earlier about this baseball dilemma. The players, it looks like the owners may tell them 50 games, take it or leave it. If you were a player, an active player, would you take it?
Man, I'm on this business side now. The reason why they want 50 games is to save money because they have contracts with Fox TV, ESPN, and all these other TBS and all these other stations. So, you know, everybody's at home watching, you know, so everybody's going to be watching. They're going to be using, they're going to get paid off a TV right. And they're going to make a lot of money. And some are already making the money because they're contracts for 10 years, $3 billion worth, 10 billion, I mean, 10 years. And so if you do 50 games and then pay them the prorated rate of their contract, then you only paying them a little bit, right? But the players want to go 114 so they can get at least half of their contract. But if you go 50 games, you're paying them less, and you get, and they get to hoard the money. That's why they won't open the books.
Right. So what should the players do?
The players got to keep negotiating, man. They got to get to at least 82 games, at least. You know, 81, 82 games, just a half a season. And then I understand the business side of the players because I'm in business. I get both sides. And you know, you go at 50 games, they go at 114. Now they come halfway and everybody's happy. You got to start. If you negotiate, somebody got to start low and someone has to start high. That's what they're doing. And it's going to get done. That's what I believe.
So there's no proration on the TV side for the owners?
See, that's something we don't know. You know what we make. You don't know what they make.
Yeah, because
if it's not a proration on the TV side, then I take mine back because I said I play the 50 games. But if it's because I'm automatically assuming the TV side for the owners would be a proration too, because if I'm paying,
I think the owners keep the TV money.
No, nah, but then I need to get more money then.
Right.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I thought it was going to be a proration. Just makes sense, right? In business, you would think if I'm a television network and you're only giving me 50 games, then I need the rest of my money back.
Yeah, Tori, that's a great – you laid it out in a very interesting way. Hey, Tori, we know you only had a few minutes. Thank you for doing this, man. Stay safe. All the best to you and your family.
Hey, anytime for you guys. Call me anytime, man. Keyshawn, man, good to hear your voice again, man.
Yes, sir, baby.
And as promised, we have Mike Tannenbaum, former NFL GM, who now does such great work for ESPN Woo-hoo! Online. Mike, how you holding up?
Morning, guys. Good to be with you.
Mike, how did you screw up the Keyshawn Johnson trade?
You mean, how did we get so much for Keyshawn?
Mike, what do you remember?
Hey, don't get me started, Mike, because y'all got two picks for me and didn't win a damn thing.
Mike, do you remember like every detail of that trade, or would you have to go look it up?
Absolutely. So. It was a really interesting time in my career. It was actually arguably one of the most fun years of my career from a standpoint that Coach Parcells was the GM and Al Groh was the head coach. And I remember one of the things he had talked about was obviously Keyshawn was a great player, former first pick in the draft. But he talked a lot about how that, hey, I'm no longer the head coach. Al Groh's the head coach. And let's do what we can to get as many young players on the team that fit his vision. So Keyshawn was our best player, and fortunately, Rich McKay was a USC guy and gave us two first-round picks for him.
And I went on to win a Super Bowl, and Mike is working at ESPN now.
Oh, that's
so
cold.
Go figure. I'm retired, though. You mighty young to be retired. But, no, I'm just teasing, which you know I love you, man. You actually tried to redo my deal a couple times, even though – I had years left on my contract. The one thing I can say about Mike Tannenbaum being a general manager, he always wanted to pay the players. It was never any issues with getting your money. Never.
Yeah. In all seriousness, one of the things that people don't give you enough credit for, Keyshawn, and I learned this from Dan Henning, was not only were you a great receiver, but you were an unbelievable blocker, and he loved putting you in the slot and going the line of scrimmage with two plays. And if they went small, we could run the ball because you were such a great point of attack blocker. And if they went big, we could throw because you were a great mismatch. So, you know, a lot of people are very focused on your statistics and your production, but well beyond that, you were a great complete player. So, I just want to make sure people realize that as well.
Hey, Mike Tannenbaum is our guest. Let me put you into the Saints locker room, general manager's office. If you were the GM of the Saints, and Sean Payton's a veteran guy. He's dealing with this right now. How would you handle this Drew Brees thing? And what do you think about the way that's all playing out?
Sure. You know, we talked about it on Get Up this morning. And look, unfortunately, there's been unbelievable tragedies recently. And obviously, there's been a tremendous amount of social injustice in our country. And what you hope good comes out of this is meaningful change well beyond this recent news cycle. And what I was talking about today is the best type of leadership, and I'm sure Keyshawn would agree with this, is player-led leadership. And Drew Brees made a mistake, and he apologized, which seems to be in a very earnest and sincere way. It seems like some of his teammates have accepted that apology. But I think more importantly than any of that is that he's held accountable, and actions do speak louder than words. And hopefully a whole bunch of positives comes out of this, and they work with the community, and I have no reason to believe that they won't, where they could actually make meaningful change. Like we see the Jacksonville Jaguars today as a organization march. I think that's a great example of what we're talking about. And I think from a GM standpoint or from a head coach standpoint, that leadership isn't nearly as good as if a player does it. So I think it was a step in the right direction, and we'll see where it goes.
And speaking with everything that we're doing and going through, Vic Fangio had a similar situation going on. You being a general manager, having had to hire head coaches and fire head coaches. And Vic Fangio went on to say that there was no racism that he's seen, or discrimination for that matter, in the National Football League. How would you handle him as a general manager, Mike?
Yeah, Key, that's a great question. And, again, I think that's another situation where Coach Fangio made a mistake. And I think I don't want to speak for him. I think he was trying to talk about parts of the NFL are a meritocracy and the best players play. He obviously needed to be educated, and I think his intentions were correct, but he was wrong. And I think it's another example where, you know, education and enlightenment is what you need to do. And, you know, Coach Fangio has a good track record for a long time. I think what he said was wrong, and I certainly didn't agree with it. And hopefully he learned from it. And as an organization, you want to put him in a position where, again, it doesn't happen again. He can learn from it, and he was truly remorseful for what he said.
How do we know he was truly remorseful for what he said?
Well, that's a fair
point. How do we know that he's not remorseful because he got criticism as opposed to what he said?
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. I guess we have to go by what we see. And, again, a little bit what I touched on with Drew Brees. You know, we have to hold him accountable to what he does moving forward, and he certainly came across as being sincere and remorseful, and so did Coach Fangio. So I think that's a really fair point. We have to see how he behaves and acts and how things go moving forward. But I guess if you want to give him the benefit of the doubt, you would say his apology did appear to be sincere.
We're talking with Mike Tannenbaum, who works for ESPN, former NFL GM. Mike, they're dealing, and I know these situations are all similar, but they're dealing with a situation up in Buffalo where they took a rookie quarterback, Jake Fromm out of Georgia, fifth-round pick, and he sent out a really offensive text. It came up. I'm curious, from a GM perspective, this is a rookie. He's a fifth-round pick, so he was probably on the border as to whether or not he was going to be in your quarterback room anyway. Do you let a young guy like that apologize, accept his apology, or is it so toxic what he wrote and what he did that it's just easier to cut a guy like that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would seriously consider all the circumstances and think about, you know, moving on and looking at, is that tweet a pattern of behavior? What was the context of that? And I would take a really deep dive on that. That was really disappointing to see. And that's something that can't be tolerated in the organization, regardless if he's a player, a first-round pick, fifth-round pick. So I would certainly take a deep dive on that and see, you know, what.
But Jim, Mike, you know what I'm saying. If he's a first-round pick, you're not cutting him. I mean, you have too much invested in it. But a fifth-round pick, you could make an example out of, couldn't you?
Yeah, but again, if it was a first-round pick, you know, you're still, there's other things you could do. Like those tweets are not acceptable. So. How you handle it as an organization, typically, like when I've been in situations where you're dealing with player discipline, moving on from a player, you bring your head coach, your owner in, you talk to player leadership, you look at the situation, and then you make that best decision you can with all the information that you have.
Mike Tannenbaum.
I want you to put on a
former general manager in NFL joining us here on the morning show. Mike, real quick, I want to know how the vetting process, though, because things like these tweets – to get into the league, right? They seem to get drafted. They seem to get into the league. When there's other issues with players, whether it's domestic violence or drugs or red flags, they seem to have issues where they're kind of pushed out of the draft positions, where these other guys are pushed into draft positions. How does that happen?
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. I can only go by my experience, and I was involved with a very unique situation a couple years ago with Laramie Tunsil, where Laramie was video doing something wrong. He was the best player on our board. We were sitting there with the 13th pick. We did a lot of homework on him. And again, I think context is important. Laramie was a really good person. We did a ton of work on him, and we took him with the 13th pick. And it was a great opportunity when I was with the Dolphins. Likewise, when I was at the Jets, be it guys like Santonio Holmes or Antonio Cromartie, guys that have had bumps in the road, Plaxico Burress, you know, we felt like if we did our homework and looked at guys that may have made mistakes, had bumps in the road, but we could work with them, it could be a win-win for them. It could be a win-win for the team. So, again, I think every situation you have to do a deep dive on, including a situation like Jake Fromm, and see was it a good person that made a mistake, or is this a pattern of behavior? And either way, that tweet is not acceptable.
Mike, I know you got TV coming up. We really appreciate you doing this. I know it was a day with a lot of issues, so we appreciate you coming on with us. And most of all, stay safe. Thank you for doing this.
Yeah, no, really appreciate it, guys, and it's really a pleasure to be on it. And I know these are difficult conversations, but ones that we need to have, and one that hopefully we could all learn from, and really appreciate being having the opportunity to do so.
Thanks, right, Mike. Have a great day. There's
thanks,
Mike, Mike Tannenbaum. Hey, LZ and Key, let me have you guys weigh in on that Jake Fromm question. Here's what he tweeted. Somebody dug this up. It was a 2019. It was posted to Twitter early yesterday morning. Fromm wrote, quote, "But guns are good. They need to let me get suppressors. Just make them very expensive so only elite white people can get them. Ha ha." End quote. LZ, he's a fifth round pick. All right, so he was on the bubble whether he's going to make it or not. Do you let him apologize and stay in your camp? Or is this one of those situations where you could say, you know what, we need to show that this is completely unacceptable. We're going to cut you. What would you do?
I would let him apologize and keep it rolling, and this is why. They already knew that tweet was there. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's not like this is breaking
news. I don't
know
if they did. I don't know if they did, LZ. Well, I think somebody dug it up.
When was the tweet?
Was it? 2019.
2019.
So they,
he did it when he was in Georgia.
Brandon Beam, who I know very, very well.
That's the GM in Buffalo?
Yeah, it's the GM. I know him. Like, that's my dude. We, like, go back and forth on text and everything. He was with me in Carolina, and he wasn't nothing but a little peon, little scout. I think they have something in place in Buffalo that would vet the process. But this is the second quarterback in the last 3 years that has had some –
yeah, Josh Allen had an issue. Yeah.
Social media kind of like bigotry type stuff that they've had to deal with. So I don't really know if whoever's scrubbing their social media is doing a good job or are they just ignoring it. But I sure want to find out.
Do you agree with LZ, Key? You would let him apologize and keep it rolling?
Well, if I was a general manager, I probably would have never drafted him. But if I'm a teammate,
but what if you're in
it's
it now?
Whatever. Excuse me?
You're in it now. You got that. Your friend, the GM, has to make a decision now. Do you keep him? Let's say your buddy didn't know about the
tweet. I'm going to keep him. I kept Josh Allen.
Yeah, but Josh Allen exactly. Kept one pick.
I can't keep one and not keep the other. That's part of the problem in the NFL is you sending two different messages.
Yeah.
Stay on point. If you're going to stay on point, stay on that message and show this is what it is. Now, I understand certain players are treated differently. But in this situation, this is different than a guy falling asleep in a meeting.
All right, coming up next, my broadcast partner, the great Michael Thompson, will join us. Keyshawn, LZ, and Travis on 710 ESPN.